Welcome to Let's Talk ETFs. I'm your host, Jonathan Liss, and I've been closely tracking the ETF space for more than 13 years through a variety of roles here at SeekingAlpha.com. Each week, a different guest and I will take an in-depth look at a particular aspect of the rapidly evolving exchange-traded fund space, with a focus on how investors can best utilize ETFs to reach their investing goals. Before we begin, a brief disclaimer. This podcast is for entertainment and educational purposes only. Nothing said here should be taken as investment advice. All opinions expressed on this show are those of the individuals expressing them alone. A full set of disclosures will be included at the end of this show. You can subscribe to Let's Talk ETFs on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or whichever podcast platform you prefer.
And now a word from iShares by BlackRock. With iShares ETFs, you get diversified, low-cost, and tax-efficient access to the world's investment markets. iShares. Invest in something bigger. Visit iShares.com/portfolio to learn more.
For reference purposes, this podcast is being recorded on the afternoon of Wednesday, October 23rd, 2019.
My guest today is Danny Prince. Many of you will be familiar with Danny from episode 4, Winners and Losers in the Passive versus Active Debate. If you somehow missed that episode, I highly recommend you go back and listen to it after you're done with this one. For those of you meeting Danny for the first time, he is head of iShares Product Consulting for BlackRock's U.S. Wealth Advisory business. Danny has been with BlackRock iShares for 12 years with a focus on delivering ETF industry and product insights. Before joining the team at BlackRock iShares, he served as a pension consultant. He holds the CFA designation. As a graduate from the UC Berkeley Haas Business School, he stayed local in the San Francisco Bay Area where he lives with his wife and two children. Danny, welcome back to the show.
Great. Thanks, Jonathan. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, great to have you back. You are our first repeat guest, so congrats on that.
Well, I will take that as a vote of confidence here.
Definitely. Last episode went really well. We had a lot of positive feedback. People are clamoring to have you back on. And I think you're the perfect guest for this topic because we're going to attempt to take a topic which many investors feel is just about as boring as they come, ETFs in your taxes, and try to make it interesting. And the reality is that while some of the details may seem somewhat arcane, the idea of investors saving money on their tax bill and having more left over for themselves isn't boring to anyone, I'm sure, anyone that I can think of at least.
Let's make it interesting. I'll give you the headline. Let's save some money by not paying taxes. That's the headline here.
That's a headline I'm sure everybody can get on board with. That's great. So ETFs are famous for things like their low cost and transparency. Key virtue that is oftentimes overlooked with exchange-traded funds is how tax-efficient they can be, particularly relative to mutual funds. Why do you think it is that investors who can be hyper-focused on just a few basis points in an expense ratio aren't equally focused on taxes and the effect that that can have on their bottom lines?
Yeah, that's right. We'll touch upon that in a second, but that's definitely a need for a shift in focus. But sort of before we dive in, let me just sort of get this sort of uncomfortable but necessary sort of statement out of the way. You know, for those that are listening, so for individual investors and financial advisors, you know, please do seek tax guidance from a tax professional. You know, I am really knowledgeable of the ETF industry, but we want to make sure that, you know, to sort of say that on the outset here. You know, I'm in the business of staying in business. So with that, I'm done sort of with my compliance disclosure here. And now, like, sort of thinking about your question, if you go back 10 or 15 years ago, as you sort of pointed out, most people would think ETFs were more about like liquidity and low cost, maybe accessing markets in an efficient way. And it wasn't really about tax efficiency. But really today, I think investors are waking up to the notion that, hey, I can control things more than just my cost. I can control things around taxes. And here we are sort of right in the middle of fourth quarter. And this is really the topic du jour in the mutual fund and ETF industry, sort of taxes. So this is where we think taxable investors are really missing, but are starting to see. Taxes, in many cases, are greater cost to mutual fund investors than management fees on those same funds. And when you sort of look at the sort of track record, over the last 10 years, taxes on distributions have shaved off about 1.5 percentage points off of the average annual performance of funds. And if you know, think about that relative to the fees, those same funds charge about 73 basis points. So almost or more than half of that impact. And if you think about how that affects your performance, Jonathan, we recently ran some numbers. And if you look over the last 10 years again, ending in 2018, top quartile large cap blend funds had outperformed the S&P on average by about 90 basis points per year. When you look at that same metric using after-tax returns, the alpha went negative, and on average, it was a loss or a negative alpha of 60 basis points per year. So it really starts to hit in your performance. And you know what we find pretty ironic is that investors are so maniacally focused about really what's on paper on 12/31. In reality, people should really, really care about what's in their account post April 15th. And sort of you hit the nail on the head. There's so much press and talk around fees and basis points of fees and lowering fees, right? We've really been conditioned to focus on just one part of the equation. And I'd really argue we should really be thinking about the bigger part of the equation in some cases.
Sure. Yeah, I was going to say, it sounds like the basis point conversation is really kind of dwarfed by if you're talking about 150 basis points shaved off of returns, you know, those numbers never get into the basis point conversation when it comes to expense ratios. People talk about 5 and 10 and 20 basis points. So yeah, I think it's really crucial for investors to keep in mind always that the bottom line is really the bottom line, what you keep, not what you make on paper, theoretically.
That's right.
Before we get too deep into a conversation here about exchange-traded funds and how they are more tax efficient than their cousins in the mutual fund space, I think it would behoove us to spend just a few moments explaining to listeners that are maybe less familiar with how investments are generally taxed, how that takes place and how it plays out exactly. So let's just start out with capital gains here. How are capital gains assessed and what's the difference between short and long-term capital gains?
Yeah, so when you think about like, look, what are those things that cause me to sort of have a lower after-tax return? You know, there's really two things, and you sort of touched upon one, capital gains. You know, really, if you own a U.S. mutual fund, a 1940 Act open-ended fund or ETF, you know, to the extent that those funds have gains per the annual report, you know, those gains, realized gains need to be distributed to shareholders. So these are sort of, there's capital gains really in two forms. One is there's the capital gains that you have. So if you bought a fund, like let's say $10 and that had appreciated to $12, you have capital gain taxes to pay on that $2, right? Those are the sort of capital gains that I'd argue are sort of inside of your control. But when we talk about capital gain distributions, there's also sort of that aspect I was talking about where funds make distributions. So, you know, this occurs inside the portfolio and they usually get distributed in fourth quarter, you know, more likely to be in December than any other month. And to your question, this can take the form of long-term or short-term capital gains. And really, you know, the difference here can be somewhat meaningful. If you think about, you know, current U.S. tax rate, if you're in the highest marginal tax bracket, short-term capital gain rates are somewhere around 40.8%, right? And sort of long-term capital gain rate, so that's holding sort of the asset, you know, over a one-year period is around 23.8%. So you can see how sort of taxes, you know, can really vary based off the holding of the asset and when you realized over what time period.
Yeah, sure. And this is something that when we discuss the difference between exchange-traded funds and mutual funds, I think it'll become pretty clear that in the case of exchange-traded funds, investors have control. They're almost always deciding when to create that taxable event, whereas in the case of mutual funds, they have the taxable event that they can create themselves, investors, but often they end up with other unwanted taxable events because of the way mutual funds are organized relative to exchange-traded funds. But before we get into that, I'd love to discuss a couple of the other kind of broad taxation points here. So there are the gains, and then there are the gains on your investments, and then there are also the dividends or distributions. What is, for listeners that are unfamiliar, how would you describe the difference between qualified and non-qualified dividends and how an individual's marginal rate comes into play here?
Yeah, so with an income distributions, you know, and again, you know, 1940 Act funds or ETFs really pay out the tax character of the underlying investments. And there could be a difference between sort of, you know, as you mentioned, qualified and non-qualified income. So for numbers, you know, if you are, again, in the highest marginal tax bracket, and again, these numbers aren't assuming any states. I happen to live in California. I have to add on another number on top of this, probably the highest state income tax. But when you think about income, qualified income comes at a sort of like long-term favorable rate, that 23.8%, you know, from a taxation perspective. And non-qualified income, you know, comes in at about 40.8%. So you can start to see, you know, some pretty big difference there. And, you know, for non-qualified income, to rephrase this, for every $1 of non-qualified income you receive, you get to keep about 60 cents after accounting for the taxes on that income distribution. So it starts to eat pretty well into your returns. And when you think about, you know, general characteristics of asset classes, you know, taxable bonds tend to not be qualified income versus, you know, equities, especially domestic equities, which, you know, can be qualified income if you meet certain requirements around holding the security for 60 days prior to and after a distribution. So if you hold the security long enough, you can get a sort of better tax character on the dividends being distributed.
Sure. Yeah, that's helpful. And then I guess final item here before we get into the specifics of ETFs, and that is that there are different types of accounts or portfolios that investors can have. There are portfolios that are fully tax deferred, IRAs, for example, versus just kind of your standard brokerage account. And so we're going to get into, I'm sure, some of the things that investors should be thinking about with different types of investments in terms of if they have to put them in one account versus another. There are pretty strict rules around how much funding is actually allowed to go into things like IRAs on an annual basis. So what are just some of the basic rules around funding tax-deferred accounts? And why is it that many investors, particularly wealthier investors, end up with the bulk of their assets in non-tax deferred accounts?
Yeah, there's all sorts of like limitations on how much an investor can put into a qualified account. So the 401ks of the world, you know, the different IRAs of the world, the government has really limited the ability to sort of seek tax shelter from things like income distributions and things like capital gain distributions and the deferral. I mean, if all investment accounts weren't taxable, there'd obviously be some sort of shortfall at the IRS level. So, you know, there's certain caps and, you know, really it's dependent on your individual situation. There's certain income limits that prevent you from, you know, really putting in into deferred tax sheltered accounts. So, you know, what you find in the U.S. is generally the more wealth you have, the more likely you are to have sort of a taxable account. You know, the lion's share of U.S. citizens today do take advantage of things like 401ks, you know, and other IRA accounts for retirement. But again, that sort of cap is limited. You know, so, you know, you want to be mindful about, you know, taking advantage, but, you know, you can't fully take advantage if you have over a certain amount of assets.
Sure. And again, seek out that advice in terms of your personal situation from your accountant, because clearly you should be putting as much as you possibly can into tax deferred accounts. But again, depending on how much money you actually have to invest, that could be fairly limited. So definitely worth seeking out advice there. So let's get into the ETF specific conversation here. Why are ETFs tax efficient?
We'll walk through sort of like the mechanics of ETFs and why, but, you know, I think it would be useful for listeners here to really define tax efficiency. You know, like what I want to make sure the message is that, you know, ETFs like mutual fund can have taxable events. So let's like put that really crystal clear into view here. What do we mean by tax efficiency? And what we're really talking about is, you know, as a fund manager, you know, for at BlackRock, you know, we are effectively trying to minimize capital gain distributions for investors. And then we're trying to maximize qualified income. So when you think about the two types of distributions, you know, what we're really talking about, tax efficiency is really defined as minimizing capital gain distributions from the fund, maximizing qualified investors. That to us allows investors to keep more of what they earn. So let's really dig into, you know, what makes ETFs more tax efficient. Again, minimizing capital gain distributions, maximizing qualified. And the way I think about it is really,
like three different tranches. You know, the first is really the strategy of most ETFs today, and that is being index-based. So if you think about just the strategy, forget the structure of ETFs. Most ETFs today, full 98% of assets are seeking to track indexes. Generally speaking, indexes have lower turnover than active strategies. So if you think about the lion's share of assets today, they're usually in market cap weighted indexes, and that comes with a much lower turnover. So think about the S&P 500. On average, it turns over 4, maybe 5% per year. You think about the funds that are trying to outperform the S&P 500, they turn over around 60, 70% per year on average. So turnover alone lends itself as a tax-efficient strategy or low turnover. The second level, and sort of the three levels, is the ETF structure. ETFs tend to be more tax-efficient than traditional funds, you know, simply because investors are buying and selling ETFs on the exchange. Very little transactions actually occur directly with the fund provider, with like an iShares. And, you know, investors meet on the exchange, and they buy and sell with each other, and little cash flow comes in and out of the fund. And when there is sort of an imbalance between buyers and sellers, the process for which ETFs are created, so more units are sort of just given to the market or redeemed, units are taken out of the market, is generally done in kind. And what that means is securities, instead of being sold to raise cash, are simply redeemed. And that's a non-taxable event. So we can actually have redemptions in our fund and redeem out securities without selling and sort of forcing on gains. The structure really lends itself well towards, you know, trying to insulate investors from other investors' activities. So indexing as a low turnover strategy, ETF as a very efficient externalization of transactions structure. And then the last bit is how you manage the funds. So when you think about differences in the ETF industry or different strategies, you know, are you effectively as a portfolio manager doing things to help sort of minimize capital gains and maximize qualified income? Strategies like tax loss harvesting or sort of getting in front of and being aware of index changes. There's a lot that could be done sort of at the portfolio management level where, you know, sort of our goal is to track indexes and do so with a keen eye on tax efficiency. So you can see some differences really at the provider level and how you manage and sort of make trade-off decisions in tracking an index.
Yeah, sure. And then I guess the flip side of that is, so while ETFs are very unlikely, and let's make clear that they do on occasion pay out unwanted capital gains distributions to investors, they're fairly unlikely to have to do that. Mutual funds are way more likely to do that. What is it about how mutual funds are structured that causes that to happen?
Yeah, like generally speaking, mutual funds transact directly with investors of a mutual fund. So if you own a mutual fund and you wanted your money back, you simply would sell your sell order to the mutual fund company, and the mutual fund company would need to raise cash to meet your redemption needs. First, they would probably net out buyers and sellers, but to the extent there's an imbalance, portfolio managers would need to raise cash, therefore selling within the portfolio. That's sort of like investor flow dynamics. But if you go back to sort of what the strategy of most funds today is, it's to outperform a benchmark. So the sort of notion of buying low and selling high and having additional turnover from a strategy perspective is an additional headwind on sort of tax efficiency. Buy low, sell high is not a tax efficient strategy, right? It's good for alpha, but it's not necessarily, it translates towards gains that have to be paid in the current year. So the strategy and the structure are really different.
Sure. Although my understanding is, and correct me if I'm wrong here, that even index tracking mutual funds are more likely to pay out capital gains than similar ETFs or ETFs that track the same indexes because of the way that they're organized, the fact that they're pooled investments, that they're not taking advantage of in-kind transactions, and that they do have to sell shares on the open market more regularly.
That's correct, right? Like, you know, maybe it's not a strategy of buy low, sell high. Maybe it is indexing, but they still sort of need to meet investor redemptions with cash. So, yeah, that's definitely
a consideration. You know, if you think about the spectrum, Jonathan, like if you go pure actively managed mutual fund all the way down to pure index ETF, you know, somewhere in the middle or even maybe even closer to pure index ETF would be index mutual funds from a sort of capital gain distribution standpoint. So it's a spectrum.
Sure. And it's just, I guess, one reason where when you have a similar or same offering available, one is an exchange-traded fund, one is a mutual fund, even if the underlying expense ratio is the same, still makes sense from a tax efficiency perspective to probably go with the exchange-traded fund in most cases, for most investors, without giving advice to anyone here. But that, to me, at least seems like the logical move for most investors.
Yeah, that's one noticeable difference between the two structures.
Sure.
And now a word from iShares by BlackRock. With a wide range of iShares ETFs, unlock new growth opportunities for your future, all at a low cost. Whether you believe certain sectors or countries will deliver outsized growth, you're looking for bonds to put cash to work, or you want to invest in forward-looking megatrends, iShares. Invest in something bigger. Visit iShares.com/portfolio to learn more.
And I guess to kind of bring this home, so 2018, we were discussing before we hit the record button here and before the Skype on my machine went totally haywire. So in 2018 in particular, there was really kind of a huge gap between what mutual funds did tax-wise and what exchange-traded funds did. So could you, because I know you have published some research on this, could you kind of fill us in on what the landscape was like during fiscal year 2018? And then I guess if you could get into some of the differences between different ETF issuers and lineups and capital gains also, that'd be great.
Yeah, I mean, 2018 was one of those years that you could sort of put as a case study for like how structural implications or even indexing led toward sort of, at least on a relative basis, better outcomes for clients. And you know, if you sort of reflect on what happened in 2018, it was a record year for capital gain distributions. We pulled some research going back several decades and sort of just really highlighted that, you know, this is the largest capital gain distribution on record we sort of see since going back to 2000. And, you know, something like $540 billion in capital gains was distributed to investors. And look, I'll recognize a lot of those investors may not be taxable, but a lot are. So we're talking about the largest capital gain distribution on record. And really what happened in 2018, at the same time funds were paying out capital gains, they were also down in performance. You know, it's kind of like getting locked out of your house only to realize it just started raining, right? That sort of double whammy really points to the chagrin of U.S. investors who are looking at, you know, poor performance plus capital gains. So here's some stats that we sort of pulled. 90% of active U.S. equity funds distributed a capital gain. Those distributions averaged almost 10% of NAV, slightly under 10% of NAV. Those same funds were down about 8%. So there was quite the disconnect for investors that year, sort of seeing funds pay capital gains and be down. And like really what happened was you had a decade-long bull market, really sort of gains are being sort of manifested in portfolios. And as sort of investors, you know, started pulling out their money out of funds, we saw a high amount of redemptions. It triggered portfolio managers needing to sell to raise cash. And a lot of those positions were still in up from a capital gain perspective. So that sort of triggered this event. And this something sort of what we saw in 2008, 2009. As funds started to perform poorly, you saw capital gains. Sort of that disconnect of investors sort of waking up and going, wait, why am I getting a capital gain if I'm down? So we saw that dynamic in 2018, and you know we're starting to see some capital gain estimates come out here in 2019 taking shape here. You know, you asked about differences in ETF providers, and you know what I'll say is, you know, as a category, ETFs do a really good job of minimizing capital gains, but there can be some differences with different providers. And you know, without sort of disparaging any of our large competitors out there, you know, what I'd ask investors to do is just pay attention to, you know, ETF providers that tend to do fairly well from a tax efficiency standpoint, again, minimizing capital gains. Here at iShares, we have something like 96% of our funds have not paid out a capital gain over the last few years. So it really speaks to, you know, that third level of tax efficiency we talk about. How do you manage, right? How do you manage to investors, to taxable investors? And, you know, just digging a little bit deeper, some of it comes back to the strategies that you offer. right? So I'll give you an example of where ETFs are more likely to pay capital gains. If you think about currency hedged ETFs, you know, the way that you hedge out the currency is use forwards, currency forwards to hedge out the sort of currency exposure. If the forwards are working and they're rolling, you're realizing capital gains and those will be distributed to investors. So firms that have more sort of currency hedged ETFs or other strategies that leverage forwards or futures, you might likely see more capital gains come from those providers. So two differences with ETF providers. One is those that sort of manage towards tax efficiency, and the other one is the strategies that don't necessarily lend themselves towards tax efficiency.
Yeah, sure. No, that's well put. And I do remember well that that period from 2008, 2009, where markets were really down in a way that, you know, people hadn't experienced really since probably their grandparents had in the Great Depression. And yet when they got done with it, all the people that were redeeming funds, either panic selling into that sell-off or just needed to have some cash be liquid, maybe they had lost a job or something, just created these massive redemptions and massive capital gains events. So it really was that that double whammy that you described of being locked out of your house and then getting caught in a thunderstorm also at the same time. So yeah, that's well put. In terms of other types of exchange-traded funds, getting beyond the equity space here, what does it mean exactly when a bond fund is advertised as being tax-free?
Yeah, so there's certain asset classes, and this goes back to sort of like looking at your entire portfolio, figuring out what your tax rate is, and sort of optimizing for after-tax performance. But, you know, some bond funds get promoted as being tax-free. In the U.S., these are generally municipal bond funds. So, you know, municipal bonds, you know, more generally speaking, offer income that is free of sort of federal and, depending on the state of issuance, state taxes as well. So you'll see a lot of bond ETFs out there covering munis that, you know, claim sort of tax-free income. And many of the bond ETFs out there even include a special condition where it's bonds that aren't eligible for AMT. So the sort of additional tax of the alternative minimum tax, you know, making sure that bonds that are selected in the particular fund aren't AMT eligible. So there's plenty of bond ETFs out there covering the muni space that can give you that tax-free income.
Sure. And then I guess you could even get to triple tax-free level, for example, if you reside in San Francisco, as you do, and you owe municipal taxes also, and you buy a bond fund that holds, let's say, bonds that are issued by the city of San Francisco. So you might actually get out of all three levels of taxation there in that case. But again, necessary to consult with a tax expert in anyone's personal case here. So moving on to another type of ETF wrapper that or investment in an ETF wrapper that I think is sometimes misunderstood, physical commodities. So iShares has funds like IAU and SLV, and there's other ones like GLD. They hold, you know, bars of gold, bars of silver, et cetera. And these are generally taxed as collectibles. So first of all, why is that? And what does that mean for investors, practically speaking?
Yeah, so, you know, you mentioned a couple of gold funds. You know, while they are ETFs, why they are, you know, sort of exchange-traded funds, they're really legally set up as 1933 Act Grantor Trust. And what that means is basically a pass-through of a physical asset. Like, you basically own a pro rata slice of gold bars sitting in a vault, obviously, you know, guarded and protected, so forth, inspected, et cetera. So, you know, from a tax perspective, you know, those would be very similar to holding like gold bars yourself or gold coins. And as such, you know, per our sort of prospectus, you know, we think that these are more likely to be taxed as collectibles, which is a slightly higher rate than sort of like a long-term holding period. So somewhere around that sort of 28%, not necessarily including the Affordable Care Act taxes. So tax a little bit slightly higher rate than, you know, other investments because of the sort of nature of being a collectible. Just want to be mindful again of sort of different ETFs being taxed at different rates.
Yeah, definitely. No, and they're really, I mean, when you get through the full list here, and we're not even going to go through many of them, you know, there are really so many different types of tax treatments in theory. So the next one I wanted to go through, you had already mentioned currency hedged funds that hold a combination, let's say, of you know, equitable securities, but also futures contracts. So futures are generally taxed based on the 60-40 rule. Can you kind of just walk listeners through that, how they're taxed as a combination of both long and short-term gains there?
Yeah, there's a sort of rule around the IRS, like how are futures sort of taxed or other derivatives that roll? And, you know, generally speaking, that sort of 1256 treatment is exactly what you just said. Instead of it being, you know, no matter what your time period of holding is, you know, the distribution that you would receive from a particular fund would be characterized in that sort of 60% long-term, 40% short-term. So you get that sort of blended rate depending on your tax bracket of your sort of 60% your long-term rate and 40% your short-term rate. That's generally how those distributions would get taxed. And again, a fund company like ourselves would put out this information in January for the prior fiscal year. That would get picked up by broker-dealers to include into your 1099. So you would then see that sort of impact down the road. But when you're sort of doing your due diligence and, you know, you're thinking about what's your after-tax implications, you know that some of those funds that leverage forwards, futures, other derivatives might treat the sort of gains of 60-40 on a predetermined basis.
Sure. And so you're likely to see a higher rate based on the fact that the short-term rate is much higher than the long-term one. So yeah, good for people to be mindful of that. And then I guess final one I wanted to discuss here, and again, there are other kind of different kinds of tax treatments, but the way that limited partnerships are taxed. And this could be both exchange-traded funds that are organized as limited partnerships or that hold limited partnerships in their underlying. So these funds, you know, require the issuance of a K-1 form when tax season rolls around. How is partnership income taxed differently, and why is that?
Yeah, so when it comes to certain ETFs, and usually there's like commodity ETFs that are registered under the 1933 Act as a partnership, with that comes down the sort of tax implication. And I would really characterize this as sort of, you know, a tax form that usually comes later in the year. So you mentioned this K-1. It's just taxed a little bit differently. It's basically a pass-through of sort of gains and losses. Like you own a pro rata slice of this partnership. And as a partner, you sort of receive this K-1, which will tell you what your tax liability for the partnership is. It's a little bit different than owning a 40 Act fund, which, you know, usually is a 1099 form, and you sort of know your income. Everyone shares a, you know, gets the income distributions from the fund. So, you know, part of the K-1 is they come out later in the year, usually around March, early April. So it can lead to some delays in tax filing. So it's an implication you want to think about if you're buying an ETF that is a partnership. You would expect a K-1 document that usually isn't created, you know, prior to January 31st, like you would get with your 1099 form. So just be aware that that tax form comes later and has all the tax information for your tax professional.
Sure. And I think one way for investors to kind of run an end around that is, for example, if instead of buying, let's say, something like MLP directly, if you buy it within a 40 Act fund, you could get around that that K-1 form, correct?
Yeah, there's certain ETFs that try to leverage different structures like the 40 Act to, you know, give you exposure to what traditionally maybe have been exposed as K-1, but do so through a 40 Act fund, which does not have a K-1. So there are, you know, some ETFs that try to, you know, get around that sort of K-1-like reporting, and you'll see them registered as 1940 Act fund.
Okay, sure. Yeah, that makes sense. All right, good. Now let's get on to the fun part here, which is the part where we try to, at least broadly speaking, again, without making any specific recommendations to anybody, discuss the potential for investors to save money on their tax bill at the end of the year. So there's some key strategies that have been utilized over the years that, again, I think are not as well understood. What is tax loss harvesting, and how can investors utilize this strategy to lower their tax bill?
Yeah, tax loss harvesting is really a tried and true sort of battle-tested strategy that's done pretty well for investors, where like finding a loss in your portfolio has economic value. So, you know, this whole notion of tax loss harvesting is, you know, really having either funds or stocks or ETFs that are down be an economic benefit. So if you have things that are in a loss in your portfolio and you sell them and you don't hold them within the next 30 days, then you're eligible to use that loss that you generated to offset other gains inside of your portfolio, and even including up to, I think it's about $3,000 of ordinary income per year. The key thing about
tax loss harvesting is losses, when you realize them, can be used or held in perpetuity, meaning you can use them to offset this year. And if you don't have any gains this year, they can be held for next year. So we see a lot of activity around ETFs during fourth quarter, around investors who are identifying areas of their portfolio that are down. They don't necessarily want to be out of the market. So they'll buy things like ETFs to stay equitized or stay in the market, meanwhile banking the loss to use to offset a gain.
Sure. And where does the wash sale rule come into effect here? And how is it specifically relevant to tax managing with ETFs?
Yeah, so the guidance around the wash sale rule, which is effectively washing out your losses, so you're not able to use your losses, is you have to be out of your position for 30 days and you can't buy anything, and this is the IRS language, that is substantially identical. That is pretty much the degree to which the IRS has given guidance. So, you know, selling, let's say, a stock Apple at a loss and buying it within the next few days obviously washes out that potential banked loss you could have had. So you just want to be mindful to sort of think about what's substantially identical or not. So thinking about going from a single stock to an ETF where it's diversified across many stocks is probably not substantially identical. So thinking about strategies where you could stay in the market but not breach that sort of substantially identical sort of language that the IRS has around the wash sale rule.
Sure. And without, you know, giving a specific ruling here or anything, just for example, you know, iShares has a fund, IVV, tracks the S&P 500 pretty closely. And of course, there are several other funds on the market that do the same exact thing. So generally speaking, would it be possible for somebody to sell IVV and buy SPY a few days later, or would they run afoul of the wash sale rule by doing that?
Well, I'll outline the facts. Both track the S&P 500. You know, the argument could be made that they're substantially identical, you know, and that would be in violation of the wash sale rule. However, you know, I'm not in the business of giving tax advice, but, you know, they both do track the S&P 500. So you just want to be mindful around the guidance of the IRS is that you can't sell something at a loss, buy something substantially identical, and still bank that loss.
Sure. And the rule stipulates you'd have to wait, what, 30 days, is it? I'm trying to remember.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a 30-day wash sale rule. My Series 7 is kicking in.
Nice. Another key piece of the puzzle here is knowing which funds belong in non-tax deferred portfolios and which should be held only in tax deferred accounts. And again, you know, this is specific to every individual situation, but are there any best practices you can share here in terms of the types of funds or assets that generally make the most sense to hold in tax deferred accounts?
Yeah, so this is, you know, I think this gets lost among investors, you know, this notion of tax location. So we talk a lot about asset allocation, like what's the mix between stocks and bonds that fits your risk profile and sort of gives you a sort of core portfolio to run with. But, you know, when you think about, you know, what you buy from an asset allocation perspective, think about where you locate things from a tax perspective. So for instance, if you think about, you know, different strategies like high yield bonds. You know, here's an area of the market where you can get a pretty healthy yield, 4 or 5% plus, you know, where rates are pretty low. Obviously, commensurate with the risk you take in buying high yield bonds. You know, most of the return from a high yield bond ETF or fund would be in the form of income. And that income is generally not qualified. So think about, you know, like a 5-6% yield being taxed at a 40% rate. You know, you start to really clip down the return that you earn. So if you think about locating assets that either have a high yield or high growth potential in tax sheltered accounts like your IRAs of the world, you can really start to benefit your overall portfolio by thinking about, you know, segregating your assets by what's tax inefficient, high yield bonds, you know, what tends to be more tax efficient, maybe domestic equities that pay dividends, they're taxed at a maybe potentially favorable rate. So you may want to put those in your taxable account. So don't just think about your asset allocation, think about the location of your assets. Bottom line, put your less tax-efficient asset classes in your tax-deferred accounts and your more tax-efficient asset classes, things like dividend-paying stocks, things like muni bonds we discussed, put that in your taxable account and you can optimize sort of your after-tax performance across all your accounts. I mean, the benefit of having tax-deferred accounts is you can really start to locate assets, take advantage of what are typically not tax-efficient strategies, but do so with deferring or not paying taxes on the income received.
Yeah, sure. That is really sound advice. And Danny, I want to thank you for being so generous with your time today, particularly through all the technical glitches we had here. Any final thoughts before we wrap up here?
Yeah, I would just say I'd go back to the beginning of what we were talking about. Put taxes on the forefront of your mind when you think about your portfolio. It does have a larger impact, do you think? There are things like this year's fourth quarter capital gain estimates, which you can be aware of. So make sure to make this part of your consciousness. Taxes impact your portfolio returns. You are trying to receive better outcomes after 415, not 1231. That's my sort of ending message to the audience of your podcast.
Yeah, sure. And hopefully everybody takes it to heart and ends up with more money in their pocket and not just theoretical money on a paper statement this time around next year. Anyway, where can investors that want to learn more about this issue go to online to do so?
Yeah, we spend a lot of time at BlackRock talking about tax efficiency. If you go to iShares.com, we have a whole sort of tax efficiency portal to learn information about what we discussed today. You know, and if you're a financial advisor, BlackRock does an exercise each year in a tool called the BlackRock Tax Estimator. We sort of collect and sort of analyze capital gain estimates across the fund industry to really think about, what is the tax impact for this calendar year from a capital gains perspective. So if you're a financial advisor, reach out to your BlackRock representative or Google BlackRock Tax Estimator and sort of, knowledge is power here, right? Knowing what capital gain estimates are out, whether you own those funds or not, whether you choose to take that distribution or not in the next sort of couple months, it's really up to you. And it's one of the few times in the industry we have information about the future that can impact our portfolio ready for us to make a decision. So if you own funds, understand if they're paying gains and whether or not that makes sense for you to remain in the fund.
Thanks again, Danny. This has been great. Hope we can do it again soon.
Great, Jonathan. Appreciate the time.
For disclosures, neither Danny nor myself have positions in any of the funds mentioned in today's show.
If you've been enjoying Let's Talk ETFs, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. And if you find this podcast useful, please consider leaving a review on one of those platforms so that other investors can discover it. You can also find this podcast on seekingalpha.com by typing Let's Talk ETFs into the search bar at the top of the site.
And now a word from iShares by BlackRock. With iShares ETFs, you get diversified, low-cost, and tax-efficient access to the world's investment markets. iShares. Invest in something bigger. Visit iShares.com/portfolio to learn more.